Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, growing expert on the art of herkle-derkling.
I don't know what that means, but I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio. What does that mean?
Well, it's an old Scottish term for what the Chinese youth are calling bed rotting, where you just hang out in bed all day and do whatever you want. You're awake, but not awake.
So retirement is doing you well.
Yeah, exactly.
The voice of a retired law professor, yes. But anyway, welcome to Movies 101, the show that would rather spend a hot summer's day in the cool of a theater than do pretty much anything else, except perhaps herkle-derkle. It's now June, and the summer movie season is well underway, which means that theaters are full of racing engines and blazing weapons. That pretty much describes two of the films that we'll be discussing this week, the first being the latest in the Bad Boys franchise, Bad Boys Ride or Die, and the second being George Miller's Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. We'll follow that with a look at Tom Tykwer's 1999 film Run Lola Run, which is enjoying its 25th anniversary re-release. Let's begin, though, with another teaming up of Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. The first teaming of the duo came in 1995's Bad Boys, which was Michael Bay's directorial debut, and it presented to the world all the traits that Bay brought to the big screen. Fast cars, blazing guns, exploding cars, luscious-looking women, even more luscious cinematography, quick-cut editing and rat-a-tat comedy stylings blended with, at times, dramatic, if implausible, crime-fighting action. The merging of all these characteristics proved popular, leading to three sequels culminating in the just-released Bad Boys Ride or Die. The action in this fourth film follows the events presented in the third film, 2020's Bad Boys for Life, both being directed by the Belgian filmmaking duo of Adil El Arbi and Bilal Fallah. But you don't really have to worry about catching up because the screenplay offers up enough exposition to clue us all in on what's going on. That is, it does, if you can catch the dialogue amid all the explosions and shootings and yelling that both Smith and Lawrence do. It all has to do with a conspiracy to frame our heroic duo's former and late captain, played again by Joe Pantoliano, that Mike, played by Smith, and Marcus, played by Lawrence, fight to prove his faults. And it's all familiar, something that screams summer movie season and is as enjoyable as just that, something you can see, laugh at, or with if you prefer, and then forget 5 minutes after leaving the theater.
I am at once the perfect person to talk about this movie and the worst person to talk about this movie, because this is just a fun summer movie. It's silly, it's stupid, but Bad Boys Ride or Die works for me because I have always liked Martin Lawrence. Now, I know he's not the funniest or the most politically correct person on the planet, but for whatever reason, going all the way back to his appearing in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, to Big Mama's House, to his stand-up, to his Saturday Night Live performance, which was almost banned, I think.
I liked at Martin, least for some period. His sitcom.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there
My parents let me stay up late to watch it.
Wow. Yeah. So there's something about him. It's sort of the confused, hapless, yet innocent, I guess, portrayals that he does, especially in the Bad Boys series, that somehow just appeals to me. And I'm sure that the studios thought it was a risk maybe to bring Will Smith out of his brief hiatus after the Oscars debacle of a couple of years ago. And so I think that they were sort of rolling the dice that this would work yet again. And to my way of thinking, it does. Dan, you mentioned something in the intro about a plot. I don't even know if it has a plot. I mean, it does, I guess. But it's ultimately a film about relationships and family and friends and so forth. And for whatever reason, I had a lot of fun at this movie. To me, it's a quintessential summer blockbuster movie. And so I'm telling people, hey, you know what you're getting into. If this has worked for you in the past, I think you should go see it.
Well, in the last Bad Boys movie, Bad Boys for Life, which really should have, since this is the fourth one, this one should have been Bad Boys for Life, but they missed a chance there. That was one of the last movies I saw in the theater before everything
right.
shut down. That was an early 2020 movie. And so I had kind of forgotten the stuff that happened in that. A lot
Dan said the same thing, yeah.
But I thought this movie actually did a pretty good job of reminding me of the plot. Like, oh yeah, Will Smith has that kid whose mother was like a drug lord and he's in prison. And oh, that's right, Joey Pantoliano died in the last one. And now, you know, his name has been tarnished and they're trying to like fix his reputation. I mean, there's a thin plot, but it all kind of gets like thrown at you at the end because there's this crooked mayoral candidate and this abandoned theme park with alligators in it.
Albino alligators.
Yeah, and at one point they're in a helicopter that's crashing and it's pretty ridiculous. And I was thinking the last movie felt to me like the Bad Boy series takes on Fast and the Furious because they introduced this big team with all these younger cops, you know, that had like computer skills and things like that. They're not in this as much. What I thought of Bad Boys Ride or Die was that this feels like a Michael Bay tribute package almost. And he shows up in a little cameo.
He's in it. Yeah.
Yes, he was in the last one too. And these filmmakers who are credited as just Adil and Bilal, I mean, they're pulling out all the Michael Bay stops, you know, those sweeping shots,
which I thought worked.
There are moments where, and we've talked about this on the show a lot, this idea that so many movies now are kind of shot indifferently or without much thought. They're putting the camera all over the place. There's a scene near the beginning where there's this running thread where Martin Lawrence just wants to eat junk food, but he has a heart attack and a death scare at the beginning, and so he has to be healthy now. And he goes into this convenience store and he's ogling all the food, and they've got the camera like behind the wall of the hot dog oven. They've got it inside of his watch. They've got it attached to their guns. It's all over the place. And so even though this is a really, really stupid movie, and it seems even stupid to say this, but politically murky as well, because it does try and wade into that and it doesn't do a very good job. But it's made with a lot of energy. And if you're going to make a movie like this and it is just going to be some dumb summer fun, you might as well inject it with style. And they've got style to spare.
Yeah, and you know what? It seems to fill all the requisites that you've had. You've complained lately, the last couple
what?
Of years.
What? Me complain?
Yeah.
I don't know.
About these action movies in which the camera gets so close to the action, you lose what's going on.
Yeah.
That does not happen in Bad Boys Ride or Die.
There's a little chaos near the end, I think.
Well, I mean, it's
not
chaotic.
Enough. Yeah,
but,
yeah. But it's not enough that you can't tell what's going on. And yeah, I mean, I had a lot of issues with this, of course. I was also disappointed that Ray Seahorn shows up in this from Better Call Saul, one of the great performances on TV in, you know, the last decade. And she's completely wasted. She's Joey Pantoliano's daughter who wants vengeance.
Right.
And,
I agree.
And nothing
that wasn't
really
the right
comes
role
of that.
For her. Yeah.
No, not
yeah.
really. She just has to glower a lot.
But right. I did like Armando, the guy
He's,
who played.
He was son.
Yeah.
He was a stud.
Yeah.
Absolutely a stud.
Well, he takes out a bunch of guys with a big weight in the prison yard.
That yeah. Way. So the one thing that we're kind of shuffling around here is the scene where Martin Lawrence slaps Will Smith.
I didn't want to spoil it.
Come on.
I thought that was a great moment.
Yeah,
and honestly,
so
it was.
And it's such a calculated PR stunt.
Because he slaps him and says, bad boy.
Yeah,
slaps him, bad boy.
Yeah, and it feels very calculated in this. It's sort of like the last step or maybe the first step in some kind of public rehabilitation.
Yes.
I do wonder if people are going to get the joke, you know, to the Oscar slap, because I saw it with a friend who didn't immediately pick up on that.
Really?
And I had to say, because it comes late in the movie.
Yeah.
It
right,
comes
right.
in the middle of, again, a really chaotic action scene. So, you know, you might miss it. But
that in itself, I think, is genius because they don't overdo it. It's like it's there, but maybe not there if your friend missed it.
And Martin Lawrence kind of gets to go wild in this movie in a way that I feel like he hasn't in some time. And Will Smith has always been, you know, the straight man in this equation. I like the moments when you can tell that they're almost cracking each other up, like they leave that stuff in the movie. Mm. But there are just moments where Martin Lawrence is doing the dumbest, broadest comedy imaginable. And there are a couple times where he got me, I got to say, where I laughed and I went, yeah, I mean, he's being funny. And I'm not as big a connoisseur of his work as you are. But I thought he was having a good time in
this.
Yeah,
he was having a good time.
Yeah.
And I think that they introduced the characters in such a way that, you know, he has this physical problem to overcome. We're not exactly sure why they let him back on the job like 2 minutes
it
after having
no
his heart
sense.
Attack.
Yeah.
But you just have to suspend your disbelief. And then Will Smith's character, having undergone this trauma in the last movie, you know, sort of has these panic attacks and they're sort of dealing with that. So it's sort of a commentary on aging bad boys and so forth. And I don't know if you're willing to just go in and, you know, this is a popcorn movie. There's just no two ways about it.
I think that you have summed it up exactly perfectly, Mary Pat, that this is the quintessential summer movie. You know, I mean, it's just full of action. You don't have to think too hard about it and you don't have to carry it very far out of the theater. It's just it is what it is. So I think most people would really appreciate that. At any rate, that was our discussion of Bad Boys Ride or Die. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, and the 25th anniversary re-release of the 1999 film Run, Lola, Run. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Meet Spokane Public Radio at a farmer's market near you this summer. Grab some fresh local produce and stop by our booth to pick up SPR fans, window stickers, and station information. SPR staff, volunteers, and hosts will be in our community at farmers markets this summer. Visit the events section on SpokanePublicRadio.org to learn when and where you can meet us at the market.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss the latest of the Bad Boys franchise, Bad Boys Ride or Die. Let's now move to another franchise offering, Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, before ending with Tom Tickford's blend of crime, love, and magical realism titled Run, Lola, Run. Let's begin with a bit of Miller time. That would be George Miller, of course, the Australian filmmaker who has made a career out of telling tales about a dystopian Aussie world and the characters, mainly a former highway cop named Max Rockatansky, who inhabit it. Like the Bad Boys Quartet, which we addressed in the first half of the show, Miller's Mad Max franchise is a multi-film collection. It began in 1979 with Mel Gibson, then an unknown actor, portraying the aforementioned Max Rockatansky, who fights his own private war against the motorcycle-riding hordes that gradually overwhelm society. Furiosa is the fifth chapter in the series and is a prequel to 2015's Mad Max Fury Road, which introduced the character of Imperator Furiosa, then played by Charlize Theron. Furiosa, the film, then, is an origin story, taking us back to when the youthful girl, played by Ayla Brown, is kidnapped from a secret sanctuary set amid the desert wastelands, witnesses the death of her mother, played by Charlie Fraser, is adopted, if that's the right word, by the gang leader Dementis, played by Chris Hemsworth, before growing up, the older version played by Anya Taylor-Joy, and seeking revenge. It's all pure Miller, with action sequences that match anything ever put on film, and despite its at times comic asides, it's also a dire look at a potential real future for all humankind.
We talked in the first half of the show about Bad Boys Ride or Die being, you know, a quintessential popcorn movie. It's fun but disposable. Furiosa is also kind of a popcorn movie, I guess. It does have the big action set pieces, but I mean, this is in a different camp altogether.
Absolutely.
I mean, I love when these old guys come out and really show you how it's done, show the young guys how it's done. Because, I mean, George Miller may be the best action director alive. And in Furiosa, there's less action than there is in Fury Road, because
right.
If you'll recall, Fury Road is basically one long action scene that occasionally stops for story and character development.
It's much more like the second one.
The Road Warrior.
Road Warrior,
yeah. I mean, this saga part of the title is right. This is basically like a big fairy tale, and it's sort of done in the style of this legend that's being passed down, sort of these breathless stories about Imperator Furiosa and where she came from and what she's all about. And so we really do get to know more about her, and it has this mythic quality to it. And it ends right where Mad Max Fury Road begins.
Yep.
And of course, just a couple days after I saw Furiosa, I had to go back and rewatch Fury Road again, which is one of my favorite movies. And I was really surprised how well they kind of click together and how seamlessly they click together. This doesn't feel like a prequel that George Miller is just making because he wants to, you know, kick the franchise can down the road a little bit more and collect some money. I mean, Furiosa really does feel like a deepening in a way of this material, and somehow makes this world and this character, who is, you know, just kind of a cog in an action plot, into a flesh and blood human. And I was really surprised by that. And I think Anya Taylor-Joy does a really good job in a performance that is silent for long stretches of time. She has to act with those big expressive eyes she has. And then you have Chris Hemsworth playing the ultimate George Miller villain. I mean, he's having a great time.
Yes, he is.
Riding on his chariot that's pulled by gleaming motorcycles. I mean, it's
three
so
of
ridiculous.
Them, yes.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I had a really good time with this. But I'm also, I mean, every time George Miller revisits this world, I'm just in awe all over again of how much detail there is in this, how much thought was put into every single element of the production. It doesn't have that shock of the new
yeah.
that Fury Road had. I mean, how could it? But I think as a continuation of the story, it's really satisfying and just really well done.
And who would have thunk that that original film, which
Mad
was
Max.
Basically
yeah.
Mad Max, which was basically like a garage band version
yeah.
of the story,
yeah, yeah.
would turn into something right. that is so professionally done.
That original one is so slow
yep.
and low budget
yeah,
and
yeah,
gritty,
low budget.
And we've
Absolutely.
Gone way past that.
Well, and I think that we do need to highlight the young Furiosa in this particular version. Yeah, I thought she was really good. And at one point, I wasn't really sure when Anya Taylor-Joy was going to show up. And that's sort of an odd segue because there's a time lapse that we don't necessarily appreciate fully.
Yeah, she doesn't show up for like an hour.
An
right,
hour,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
so I was like waiting and waiting, but I thought the young one did a great job. And then I was also very skeptical about Anya Taylor-Joy taking over Charlize Theron's role because I was like, I don't think that's going to work because Charlize Theron is this big presence, this beautiful, you know, almost Valkyrie-like yeah. person. But Anya Taylor-Joy won me over because of that stare. I mean, she's just like staring at you with those wide eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's just so unnerving and
just like
creepy.
A silent
and,
movie.
Star. Right, mm-hmm. exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I couldn't follow some of the different, I couldn't figure out who is aligned or allied with whom at any given point, because it does, the alliances do shift back and forth somewhat. But in the end, I don't think that really mattered. Like, I was a little bit of a reluctant participant, but I have to say Furiosa won me over, and it was due to the performances. So I would definitely highlight George Miller's acumen as a director, but I think, you know, he's got to have good people to work with too, or it doesn't play out.
And one we haven't mentioned is Tom Burke, who
yeah.
has, who,
oh, yeah.
who there's a digression in the storyline and you think it's going to go in one direction and then whoops, it goes back. I thought Tom Burke, who we saw in the movie The Souvenir,
yeah.
and was like, this is the same
no,
guy?
I, you, yeah, this, it was hard to
amazing
recognize
in this
him.
Film.
And he was Orson Welles in Mank.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned Chris Hemsworth. And
Hemsworth.
You know, he was so over the top. He almost went over the top, but he pulled it back just at the point where you're like, this could become insufferable.
And the movie ends not with another big explosion of action, but with this one-on-one confrontation between these two characters, and I think it works really well. It's not what you're expecting, but it makes all the sense in the world.
And, yeah. you know, just the set pieces, I mean, I think it was beautiful. It
yeah.
was beautiful.
Oh, and that action scene in the middle where she's underneath
yeah.
the truck.
Yeah,
it's incredible. Yeah.
yeah. Let's now turn from Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, and celebrate the re-release of a film that was one of the best to emerge from the 1990s. And that film would be Run, Lola, Run, an inspired 81-minute creation that plays with time and place, telling and retelling the same story three full times and ultimately ending with a well-deserved happy face. Written and directed by the German filmmaker Tom Tykwer, the film stars Franka Potenta as Lola, a tattooed rebel of a young woman who in the different plot lines must raise 100,000 Deutschmarks, worth something like $500,000 at the time, in just 20 minutes to save her clueless boyfriend, Manny, played by Moritz Bleibtreu. The critic Owen Gleiberman described Tykwer's film as a candy-colored punk Berlin fantasia, and it would be hard to top that, except to say that, save for Pulp Fiction, Run, Lola, Run may be my favorite film of the whole decade of the 90s.
I don't know if I would go quite that far, but I do love this movie. I mean, it feels like a very formative film for me. I saw it at just the right time, where it just completely shattered all of my still-forming notions of what movies can do, because the
or
moment
be,
or
right.
be or be about, and the moment that this movie Run Lola Run resets itself about 25 minutes in, the first time I saw it, I thought, wait, what are we doing? Like, you're allowed to do that? And of course, you know, you mentioned Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction did similar things with time and,
five
and
years
chronology.
Before, yeah.
And Tykwer is also indebted to the works of Krzysztof Kieslowski, who when I saw Run Lola Run, I didn't know who Krzysztof Kieslowski was. But now I do. And he even directed a script called Heaven that Kieslowski wrote. And so these kinds of themes and forms had been explored before, but not quite with this amount of energy and kineticism and visual invention. I mean, you could call this a gimmick film in a lot of ways, but all those gimmicks are so much fun. And the way that the dominoes fall as each of the three narratives kind of change it actually creates some emotion. Like, I was more moved by this movie this time. Those flash forwards into the future we get of all the people that she encounters are weirdly, like, tragic to me.
And, well, so, and even the happy ones. It also seems prescient in many respects.
Yes. And so, they change each time also.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, so the movie in that sense is a study of the decisions you make and the various changes and plot lines that your life can take. I just thought there's a deeper meaning here in an 81-minute action flick.
Well, and I think that that was showcased last year when the philosophy department at Gonzaga, helmed by Professor David Calhoun, assembled this group of philosophers to talk about the multiple meanings and the sort of transcendent quality of Run, Lola, Run. And I participated in that panel not because I'm a deep thinker about philosophical things, but maybe more to give it the sort of movie perspective or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we all often ask when we go back and see things from 25 years ago, hey, does this hold up and so forth? And I think that it does and it doesn't at the same time, because there was this sort of novelty about this film that, you know, may not work for people in the same way. So, Nathan, the fact that you dug deeper into that aspect of it is, I think, you know, something that people might want to take into account. And also, I think Owen Gleiberman said the one difference between watching this film now and watching it before is there was this true sense of optimism in the 90s. And now this, like, sense of hope and, you know, because are things going to work out? Is it going to be okay? And, you know, I'm not going to reveal the ending of Run, Lola, Run. But, you know, that plays out a little differently. I do have to give a major kudo to Tickver, because this is an 82-minute film or whatever.
It's like 76 minutes without credits.
Yeah, so I think sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah.
And some people need to be more aware of that
and
at three hours.
Does he pack this movie full of stuff?
He certainly does. Yeah. And that was our discussion of Run, Lola, Run. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Marie Pat Truthart, and I discussed Bad Boys, Ride or Die and Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the Saving Mr. Banks screenwriters Kelly Marcel and Sue Smith. That's what we storytellers do. We restore order with imagination. We instill hope again and again and again. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.